Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 4th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today. President Trump visits Las Vegas today to pay his respects to the victims of Sunday night shooting that left 58 people dead and hundreds of others injured. We still don't know much about the gunman or his motives, but according to Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo, he planned extensively for the massacre.
There was cameras located in outside of the room and inside of the room, along with the firearms. I anticipate he was looking for anybody coming to take him into custody.
The massacre happened at the Route 91 Harvest Festival, a three-day country music festival that drew more than 20,000 fans to Las Vegas. That's the band Big and Rich you're hearing there, leading the audience in God Bless America before the shooting happened. John Rich is one half of that band, and later he talked about the massacre.
Country music is really a unique genre, I think, because of the relationship between the singers and the fans. You know, we hang out with them, we talk to them, and I would expect a really strong response out of all of country music. You gotta pray for these folks too. You know, people say our thoughts and prayers. You actually need to pray. You actually need to speak to the Lord and say, please bring some comfort to these people, because this is beyond the pale what has happened.
Several other country musicians have since come out calling for prayer and unity, but also divided on the issue of gun control. Kenny Alpin, who's the other half of Big and Rich, said he doesn't believe guns are the problem. I don't think it's guns or gun control, Alpin said. I think it's a battle over people's hearts. I think that's where the true battle line is. It's just the good and evil. Caleb Keeter, who performed at the festival with the John Abbott Band, wrote this. He said, I've been a proponent of the Second Amendment my entire life until the events of last night. I cannot express how wrong I was. And Roseanne Cash, who's the daughter of country music legend Johnny Cash, published an op-ed in the New York Times. She called on country artists to oppose the National Rifle Association. That was a controversial statement because the NRA actively courts country music fans to its cause with cultural and lifestyle marketing that pairs people's love of country music to their feelings about gun ownership. In fact, there's a lifestyle brand behind all this. The organization calls it NRA Country.
I love NRA Country.
We are NRA Country! We love NRA Country!
Jonathan Bernstein is contributing writer for The Guardian and Rolling Stone. He's been following the cultural influence of the NRA and its intersection with country music, and he joins me now in the studio. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Millions of Americans love country music. Millions of Americans own guns. There's some interaction between these groups, but they're sort of independent phenomenon. But then the NRA in 2010, as we mentioned, launched NRA Country. Why did they do this? What was the intent behind this lifestyle brand?
The intent behind NRA Country was this came at a time when I think the NRA looked around and they looked at their aging demographics and they saw that they needed to sort of change their ways or else their main audience base was going to slowly die off. So country music provides a really natural fit for the NRA for a lot of reasons. It has become increasingly in the past 10 years, it's become a really sort of youth-based market. It's more and more popular with young listeners, and it's very popular with female and women listeners as well. So the NRA was looking around, and they're sort of doing a lot of things to figure out ways that they can attract new demographics, whether that's minorities, whether that's women, whether that's young people. And country music has sort of become increasingly mainstream and sort of almost suburbanized in the past 10 years. This is sort of mainstream commercial country music. But it still does have a sort of association with rural ideology or sort of small town mythology. So it was at the same time a very natural fit in terms of pop music, a more natural fit than, say, pop music, top 40 music, hip-hop, R&B.
You mentioned that the NRA was looking for sort of a softer side image, and a lot of the marketing of the organization, like in the 90s, was fairly alarmist, paranoid, urging people to get guns, buy guns because they needed to defend themselves, maybe even from the government. This is a very, very different attitude and approach now that you're describing.
Absolutely. If you sort of look through NRA Country's promotional materials, you will almost never see the word gun mentioned. You won't see the word firearm mentioned, Second Amendment. Every now and then they'll interview a country artist about their sort of favorite gun. But that's the exception. You're much more likely to hear them talk about sort of things like patriotism or the American lifestyle or outdoor lifestyle or hunting. The basic lifeblood of NRA Country is this single promotion they have called the Featured Artist of the Month campaign. And that's sort of how they get these names associated with the NRA. And we're talking about, you know, people that are as big as Thomas Rhett and Florida Georgia Line, who are sort of, they can sort of sell out arenas at this point in country music. And so in general, what the NRA tries to do with NRA Country is they target young up-and-coming country artists who are sort of very eager to sell records. They haven't sort of established themselves in the business yet. And they're willing to sort of use the NRA's promotional channels to help sell them records. And so once a Thomas Rhett, you know, early in his career, partners up with the NRA Country for a promotional campaign, the NRA can then, a couple years later, once Thomas Rhett is playing, you know, huge venues and has the number one song in the country, you can go onto NRA Country's website and see that Thomas Rhett is an NRA Country artist.
And is that what's in it for the artists, distribution and promotion? I mean, if you ask the artists who have partnered with the NRA or performed at an NRA-sponsored concert, mm-hmm. are they ideological? Are these artists saying, yes, I want to push the agenda? Or are they just young artists who want to leg up?
If you ask the artists, they'll say, look, this is pretty much a no-brainer partnership for me. I grew up hunting with my grandfather and my father, and I support the NRA. It's a brand and an organization that I can get behind. One artist compared it to, you know, it's like partnering with a fast food chain. That's what they told me. You know, if you ask people behind the scenes, you know, when I wrote about NRA Country last year, I spoke to a man named Ken Leviton who works for Vector Management, which manages a large number of NRA Country artists in Nashville. And he's very clear that it's about selling records. I also don't want to overstate the sort of influence of NRA Country in the larger country music world, because there are many country music fans and even people who work in the industry who have never heard of NRA Country. And there are many big country artists who have nothing to do with it. Most country artists have nothing to do with it, to be clear. And I guess sort of the main point that I'd like to make about its influence is that NRA Country and the NRA has been much more eager in the past 10 years to sort of promote its partnership with country music than vice versa.
Is it just country music? Has the NRA tried this type of thing with other kinds of art, other kinds of music?
Not that I know of. I don't know. There's no NRA hip-hop. There's no NRA EDM that I know of. But I do know that the NRA has tried in other ways to sort of target a variety of sort of young, untraditional audiences in the past 10 years. I mean, there's an NRA women channel on NRA TV, which is sort of this almost sort of like their own TV network that they have online, sort of an online TV network. They have a show called Noir featuring a host named Colin Noir, who's this like young, attractive black millennial guy who hosts a show about the NRA. So there's a whole host of initiatives on the NRA's part to attract a number of untraditional NRA demographics. But as far as music, I've only ever heard of NRA Country.
Well, given what you've reported about NRA Country, it seems like the organization is on dual tracks here, maybe according to how old the target audience is. I mean, NRA Country seems to be really positive, a lifestyle brand, mm-hmm. isn't really focused so much on gun rights or the Second Amendment. I have been to NRA meetings. I've watched Wayne LaPierre's speeches. I think it's accurate to say they're fairly bellicose, fairly paranoid, and it's a very different message. And these two things mm-hmm. still go on coming from the organization.
Yeah, and I think that the reason that NRA Country is presenting the softer side and is trying to mainstream itself is because they know that the larger mainstream American audience and the mainstream country audience isn't ready or isn't interested in hearing sort of these bellicose messages for the most part. That being said, there are these moments of intersection between those two sort of tracks of the NRA. I attended an NRA Country concert myself last year in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It was at a thing called the Great American Outdoor Show, which is this sort of week-long, massive hunting and gun sort of trade show. And it culminated in a concert at an arena in Harrisburg, an NRA Country concert. These were just normal country acts that were performing at this concert. And in between acts, you had Wayne LaPierre on screen sort of shouting that same message. So there are these peculiar and very fascinating sort of moments of intersection between those two tracks of the NRA's messaging.
Roseanne Cash is a star in the country music world and came out in favor of gun control and really against the NRA. What was the reaction there? And what's the reaction for country artists who explicitly say they're not interested in this kind of thing?
So I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind for context is when we're talking about somebody like Roseanne Cash, who is a hero of mine, I love her music, is that Roseanne Cash, yes, in many senses is an icon of country music and back in the 80s had many country hits on the radio, but she has almost zero to do with the world and the economy of mainstream Nashville country music right now. And what that mainly means is that she is never in a million years going to get played on country radio, which is the lifeblood of a young country singer who is trying to really make it as a mainstream country singer. But the environment historically in country music for artists who do want to get played on the radio has been that it's not an acceptable or remotely viable option or opinion to be sort of strongly anti-gun or strongly pro-gun control in country music.
At the same time, you report that some artists have been more reluctant to partner with the NRA since mm-hmm. Newtown and the massacre at Sandy Hook, and that some artists have been more willing to come out and make gun control statements since that time. How deep is that run? Will that continue here after Las Vegas?
Right. Yeah, I think that things in some ways are slowly changing. I think if I see the issue of gun control and guns in country music go in any direction, I see it almost sort of go in the direction of electoral politics in the sense that in the past, it's been a fairly safe bet to come out and stump for a GOP candidate in country music. That was not the case in 2016. It was to come out in support of either Clinton or Trump was a commercially toxic thing to do in country music, and no one really said anything. I see the issue of guns potentially heading more in that direction. It already has to a degree. Like you said, I spoke with some artists last year who were very frank and very upfront about the fact that they understood that partnering with NRA Country in 2015 or 2016 was a difficult decision and was one that involved a weighing of, you know, pros and cons. Drake White was one singer from Alabama who said, you know, I understand that this is a tough decision and I want sort of his words were, I want the single mother in Chicago who is pro-gun control to support me just like I want the man in South Texas who's for guns to support me. People understand that it's sort of a decision that they have to make already, and I think that decision is only going to become harder for them to make.
Jonathan Bernstein writes for The Guardian and for Rolling Stone, and you can read his coverage of NRA Country in The Guardian. Jonathan Bernstein, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
We asked the NRA to be part of this segment. They did not respond to our request. After a mass shooting, there's a familiar debate that fills the media in this country. We asked you, should we be talking about gun control?
This is Doris from Greenville, South Carolina. The right time to discuss gun control was after all the other mass shootings in this country. Shame on the White House for coming out with that statement. If the founding fathers of this country could see how the right to bear arms is being interpreted in the 21st century, I believe they would be horrified. The gun lobby in Washington has blood on their hands yet again.
We got this from Milton in Florida. We should never discuss major legislation in the wake of an emotional disaster.
My name is Stephen Beston, calling from Wilton Manors, Florida. If the Congress couldn't do something about gun control after dozens of children were killed in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, what is significant about this horrible event?
Samantha Georges from Louisville, Kentucky. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. I've needed my firearm. An arsenal to some people is 5 or 6 guns. I've got 7. So I think that gun control isn't the issue. Maybe more strenuous background checks, but even then, this guy didn't have a background. So it really is up to the person who owns the gun. And that's it.
My name is Maya, and I'm calling from Chicago. Right now is an especially relevant time to discuss gun control, but we should also be discussing it in an ongoing fashion to put pressure on the NRA and on the lawmakers to enact strict gun control in the U.S.
Hello, my name is Brett. I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Taking away the guns doesn't address the fact that if people want to hurt people, they can find a way to do it. They can do it with plumbing pipe, nails, fertilizer, and people will still be hurt.
What's your take? Is now the right time to talk about gun control? 8778-MY-TAKE to continue this conversation, or you can always go on our Facebook page.
The Takeaway is supported by AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
Thanks for joining us here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. President Trump traveled to Puerto Rico on Tuesday. The president met with residents as well as local officials trying to recover after Hurricane Maria. Here he is speaking with some of those officials.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
The president got a lot of criticism for those remarks, but the issue of who pays for disaster recovery and what stake they have in that recovery hangs behind all of this. Long before the storm hit Puerto Rico, some were calling for the island to privatize its electrical grid as a way to help with its debt. Now that the grid is mostly destroyed, those calls have grown even louder. But for Naomi Klein, who's a senior correspondent for The Intercept, the attempts at privatization in Puerto Rico and elsewhere in the Caribbean are just the latest chapter in what she calls disaster capitalism.
These disasters, as cynical as this sounds, are opportunities to push a very political and ideological agenda that one wouldn't be able to push through during normal times. Frequently, what we're seeing is a collision between heavy weather made heavier by climate change and that hitting up against public infrastructure that is weak, that is neglected. So you can respond to that by saying, okay, we're going to have disasters, but we can try to prevent those disasters from turning into these super catastrophes by getting at the underlying causes, which would mean shoring up the public sphere, which would mean more thoughtful development. But there's another school of thought that says, look, there has to be very rapid investment in these areas that have just been decimated. So let's create a kind of club med for investors. Let's deregulate. Let's give them tax breaks and tax incentives. Let's even waive restrictions on environmental standards, with the idea being that if we create those conditions, which make it friendlier for business, they'll be more inclined to move in quickly. I would say the Republican Party is firmly in that second camp, so which is why we're hearing calls, for instance, after Harvey, to suspend the Davis-Bacon Act, which is the law that requires that when you get a federal contract that you pay the prevailing wage. But then you have to step back and go, wait a minute, wasn't that exactly the worldview that created out of control development in the first place that turned Houston into this toxic soup, not just of floodwater, but all of these pollutants?
And what you're describing in the dynamic that can go on sounds like a great deal of opportunism. I think that maybe conservatives who favor deregulation wouldn't see it that way because they might see it as the best case. But opportunism is what you're describing.
Well, you know, they often don't hide that at all. When I wrote a book about this more than a decade ago called The Shock Doctrine, I opened with a quote from Milton Friedman, who was still alive at the time. This was right after Hurricane Katrina. He said, this is a disaster, but it's also an opportunity to radically remake the education system. And then he proposed a very radical vision of privatizing New Orleans' school system. And indeed, New Orleans now has the most privatized school system in the United States. And I think that Katrina is useful. While New Orleans was still partially underwater, you started to hear this talk, you know, we couldn't clean out the public housing, but God did, which is a quote from a Republican lawmaker named Richard Baker in Louisiana. And one of the things that I'm really worried about for Puerto Rico is increasingly being called climate gentrification, where these disasters become opportunities to seize valuable pieces of land, including land on higher ground. Even Jennifer Gonzalez, representing Puerto Rico in Congress, she says this is a moment of crisis that we need to benefit from. I mean, the intense risk in this moment is that, you know, the places that have just been leveled are some of the most beautiful places on the planet. They're very desirable for third and fourth homes and for all kinds of hotel development. And I've seen this again and again after these types of disasters. And I think, you know, having a president like Donald Trump in charge, who most certainly understands the value of valuable pieces of real estate, if he knows nothing else. He tweeted just recently, big decisions will have to be made as to the cost of its rebuilding about Puerto Rico. You know, really what it will lead to is a mass exodus of poor Puerto Ricans who will no longer have a place. You know, I think questions need to be asked about whose interest those decisions are going to be made in.
Let's talk about the case of Puerto Rico itself, because the electrical grid was devastated and now calls, as you mentioned, almost right away for the privatization of the electrical grid there. Do you have a sense of what that would mean for an island like Puerto Rico with an economy like Puerto Rico's to have that utility privatized?
There's no doubt that there was a crisis before this crisis, that it was deeply indebted. There was already a push to privatize the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, which is known as PREPA. They had a debt of $9 billion, or they have a debt. It's larger now, presumably because of the costs that they've just incurred. Privatizing it essentially would create a short-term cash flow increase. But in terms of the real structural problems of whether people are getting reliable power, whether they can afford the power, this is in the context, you know, of an island where 6 in 10 children are living in poverty, where there's an unemployment crisis, where there's already an austerity agenda that is severely attacking people's standard of living. So how are they going to pay for this?
And what do you see as the incentive structure with the Trump administration now? It's still relatively early days. President Trump has hired many captains of industry, both in finance and other industries, for his cabinet and other senior positions. We've seen that. One example, Naomi Klein, I can think of is the president's infrastructure proposal. It hasn't really gone anywhere yet, but it really did favor the kind of toll road model for infrastructure redevelopment that you're talking about. Are there other examples?
Well, I think what really needs to happen in this moment, and it's very difficult because it is the nature of a disaster to be focused on the most immediate concerns, is that we need to hear from the people who have been most impacted what a just reconstruction would look like, how they want to rebuild, whether it's in Houston or whether it's in Puerto Rico. I mean, in Houston, the person who has been put in charge of reconstruction in Houston is a former president of Shell Oil. We've already seen Trump use the hurricanes as a justification for pushing through a tax plan that is going to blow a $2 trillion hole in the budget. So I think there really needs to be a huge public debate about what is the message that we are receiving from this summer of hurricanes, of wildfires. What should infrastructure mean in a moment like this?
Naomi Klein, senior correspondent for The Intercept. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Naomi Klein's latest book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Let's go to New York now, and a new investigation showing that the president's two eldest children, Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr., were nearly indicted on felony fraud and larceny charges stemming from real estate deals at a Trump hotel. The story centers around the Trump Soho Hotel, just blocks from our studios here at WNYC in Lower Manhattan. The Trump Soho has a long history of financial and legal troubles, but back in 2007, the Trump family decided to sell hybrid hotel condo units within the Trump Soho. How those units were marketed to potential buyers eventually caught the attention of prosecutors. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office launched a criminal investigation in 2010. The investigation went on for years. A grand jury was impaneled, but criminal charges were never filed. A joint investigation by WNYC, ProPublica, and The New Yorker delved into the business practices that landed Trump children in the sights of prosecutors.
What we learned was that both of Trump's eldest children were under scrutiny for potential fraud and larceny charges, and that the case was quite advanced before it was ultimately closed.
That's Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for politics and policy at WNYC. Andrea, along with WNYC business reporter Ilya Meretz, worked to find out why the case dried up.
The specific question is statements that the younger Trumps made about the percentage sold in the building or the number of units that were selling. One peculiarity of condos in New York City or New York State is there is a consumer protection law that says no sales can close until 15% of the units are in process, are booked to close. What we learned is that the Trumps consistently made statements that were way out of touch with reality. 30-something percent sold, 55% sold, 60% sold. In reality, it was like 15% sold or less. So effectively, the people buying the units could argue that they were being misled, that they were being told that the units were more valuable than they really were.
Do those types of statements potentially constitute fraud?
Those statements are public statements. They were made to reporters. They were made at a press conference. So that's not in dispute, nor is it in dispute that one of the Trump Soho business partners later said in a sworn affidavit that only 15% of units were sold at the time Ivanka Trump was saying that 60% was sold. What happened was is that there was a civil suit that was filed accusing the Trumps and their business associates of a consistent pattern of outright lies. And when that happened, the Manhattan District Attorney caught wind of it and began to investigate. And what we learned in the course of our investigation, and we spoke to 20 people who had some familiarity with the case, including 7 who had read what we learned were emails between the younger generation of Trumps in which we're told they indicated that they knew that what they were saying publicly was wrong, but that they were saying it anyway. And those emails became what was the heart of a case that was building in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office against Ivanka Trump and Don Jr.
Well, Andrea, the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, got interested in this case, and you report that they came close to charging the younger Trumps with fraud that you're describing. The case was eventually dropped, though. What happened?
Enter Mark Kasowitz. Mark Kasowitz is Donald Trump's personal lawyer. He's someone that the president has turned to for over a decade to get him out of scrapes. And he's probably best known to people because he was briefly the head of the defense team on the Russia investigation for the president before he stepped back from that role. So Kasowitz decides to leapfrog over all of the other defense lawyers who had already been working on it and meets directly with Vance. Now, what Kasowitz knew and what Vance knew at that time was that Kasowitz had made a $25,000 contribution to the district attorney, which was a significant contribution prior to requesting the meeting. So Vance returns the contribution. They all meet. Kasowitz restates the defense's arguments that this was puffery, that white-collar cases are hard to prove. And 3 months later, Vance overrules his team and the case is dropped. But a month after the case is closed, Kasowitz gets in touch with Vance's fundraiser and says he wants to hold the fundraising event for Cy Vance. In January of 2013, Kasowitz holds the event, gives $32,000 himself, and over the next year raises another $15,000, in effect doubling his initial contribution.
What does Cy Vance say about all this?
That he made the right call, that he thought that there were problems with the case, and at the end of the day, he didn't think a case could be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And we asked him directly about the contributions. This is what he said.
Mark Kasowitz had no influence, and his contributions had no influence whatsoever on my decision-making in the case. Contributions by any lawyer have never, in my time as district attorney, influenced my decision-making on the merits.
Ilya Marritz, what have Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. and the rest of the Trump family said when you asked for comment on this story?
Well, they haven't said much. We didn't hear from them directly. We did hear from the Trump Organization's lawyer, Alan Garten, and his response was actually kind of odd. He didn't say anything about the criminal probe, which is really the heart of our story, but he reiterated comments that he'd made earlier about the civil case, basically saying that those buyers who wanted their deposits back, they were basically just miffed. They'd made a deposit, and then there was an economic recession, and like anybody, you know, they wanted to claw back the money that they had put down. We also did reach out to Mark Kasowitz, and he provided a more lengthy response. And he basically said, I gave to Cy Vance because Cy Vance is an uncommonly gifted public servant. I really believe in him. He uses the office of DA creatively, and I would never, ever try to influence him or anybody else through my political contributions, and suggesting that is just completely out of place. You know, and I just want to add here, there's a 3-month period between the time when Kasowitz and DA Vance meet in Cy Vance's office and the time when Cy Vance announces that they are dropping the criminal probe. We don't know exactly what happened in that period, but we do know that many prosecutors in the office continued to believe in the case, and they particularly believed in the case because they had that email evidence, and the email evidence seemed to show knowledge and intent, exactly the kind of things that you would need as evidence to prove larceny or fraud or any of the charges that they were mulling.
And Andrea Bernstein, is there a way to know in retrospect now how close Ivanka Trump and her brother may have come to being in real trouble?
Well, we do know that at the time Mark Kaczewitz came in, the prosecutors were strongly considering setting up a special grand jury, which in the criminal world is viewed as essentially a prelude to indictment. And I should say at the 11th hour, 2 days before this case was dropped, the Trumps offered a settlement in which they said to the district attorney, we won't admit any wrongdoing, but we will agree to tell the truth going forward in our marketing of the Trump Soho, and we will agree to have an outside monitor to come in to make sure that we do so.
Ilya Marritz, Andrea Bernstein with WNYC, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a confirmation hearing in the Senate today. President Trump's nominee to head up the Environmental Protection Agency's chemical regulatory program is in front of senators. Michael Dorsen only needs 50 votes. He's likely to be confirmed by Republicans. But Dorsen has a long history of fighting against the very restrictions on toxic chemicals he would be responsible now for overseeing at the EPA. And he's gotten a strong endorsement from the chemical industry that he'll be regulating. For more now, we go to Sheila Kaplan, health and science reporter at The New York Times. Sheila, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Todd.
Give us a quick overview. Who is Michael Dorsen?
Michael Dorsen is a former EPA staffer who left the agency many years ago and started his own company that does research, mostly for the chemical industry.
That's a consulting firm. What kind of work did they do?
Well, they do research for companies that are worried about federal regulations. For example, they'll do studies on whether or not certain chemicals cause cancer or birth defects, and they cover a wide range of areas. They do flame retardants, pesticides, shampoos, all kinds of ingredients in household products. But what they have in common is that nearly all of the results show that the compounds are safe. All of the results show that whatever it is that Dr. Dorsen was asked to test is safe.
So are people taking that as a warning sign that instead of being pure science and data-driven, that Michael Dorsen might be pro-industry?
Well, his critics do say that Dr. Dorsen has never met a chemical he didn't like. They say that he's never met a chemical he couldn't prove was safe. Because of that, members of Congress have a lot of questions. Senator Carper has a lot of questions on whether or not Dorsen can be trusted to be objective.
Has Michael Dorsen ever made statements suggesting that the chemical industry is overregulated or that the government is too aggressive when it comes to toxic chemicals?
Dr. Dorsen has stated again and again that he thinks that EPA is overzealous in its efforts to try to make sure the public is safe. Dr. Dorsen almost always comes up with results that make the company that paid for the tests very happy. And, you know, many people, not just the environmental community, but many public health officials, academic researchers, consider him to be almost notorious in his refusal to accept any kind of result that shows that pesticides, chemicals, other compounds, flame retardants can actually hurt people.
What kind of power would Michael Dorsen have if he were to head the chemical regulatory program at EPA to relax regulations currently in place on toxic chemicals?
Right now, EPA is starting to implement a rule that was designed to crack down on unsafe chemicals, and that the law was designed to tighten the leash on the chemical industry. So since EPA is just starting that right now, Michael Dorsen's arrival at the agency, if he's confirmed, means that there will be little to no implementation. I don't think anyone has any questions about that. Also, Dorson would join other chemical industry people who Scott Pruitt has brought into EPA already. And Senator Carper and others on the Democratic side of the committee worry that the law will not be implemented as planned.
So against this backdrop, Sheila Kaplan, that you're describing under the EPA of Scott Pruitt, what does Dorson's nomination, along with the other personnel that you just described, say about the Trump administration's attitude toward environmental regulation right now?
Well, it would be hard to think that the Trump administration is at all interested in protecting people from hazardous chemicals that are in products that we use every day.
Sheila Kaplan, health and science reporter for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Sheila.
Thank you, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Puerto Rico was not the only U.S. territory hit hard by Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Just east of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands and its population of roughly 105,000 people is going through a difficult recovery period of its own. On Monday, FEMA reported that only 15% of customers on the island of St. Thomas have had their power restored, along with just 10% of people on the island of St. Croix. Meanwhile, the island of St. John is still almost completely without power. President Trump had planned to visit the islands in September, but instead he chose to meet yesterday with the Virgin Islands Governor Kenneth Mapp on a boat off the coast of Puerto Rico. Brianna Sachs is a reporter for BuzzFeed News. She's been following the recovery efforts in the U.S. Virgin Islands for the past week, and she's currently in St. Thomas.
Most structures here sustained some damage. So on St. John, which is the smallest and most devastated island, they lost 80% of their homes. So it's really bizarre. It's like driving around kind of a war zone. It looks like in most some areas a bomb went off, you know, trees are just kind of mangled and lying everywhere and uprooted, and people's houses and cars and windows and infrastructure is kind of all over the place. So it's weird. You get kind of used to it. I'm used to it, I guess, now. But yeah, most things are kind of gaping open.
What assistance have the islands gotten so far? What does that look like?
So that's become more robust as the days go on. There have been a lot more boots on the ground here from an array of federal agencies like FEMA and U.S. Army Marine Corps and Coast Guard. So there is a much stronger presence here. You're seeing a lot of U.S. service members driving around much more than I did when I first got here. It looks like it's moving a lot faster now.
And how are residents doing with the basics, with food and water and power?
Well, most people still don't have power. I haven't really met someone who does. So generators are a really hot commodity. Like if you have a generator, like you are, you know, people are still really fighting to get those. And they can only be on for certain periods of the day. So, you know, a lot of people, that means they don't have ability to cook, right? Or, you know, a lot of people don't have running water. A lot of people still don't have basic necessities like food. The distribution centers are open and there are still long lines for people to get basic necessities. I've spoken with a lot of people, probably about 100, I would say, in the week I've been here. And when I ask what they need, you know, a lot of people say like bleach, brooms, clean sheets. Their houses are still very much soaked because they don't have roofs. And the Blue Tarp program was, I guess, slow to roll out here. That was one thing that the governor was pretty critical of and pushed for more, because a lot of people have been living without a roof or walls for a month.
So how are residents feeling about the speed of the response to the disaster on their island? Do they feel like it's come fast enough?
When I first got here, you know, people were really frustrated. They weren't really visibly seeing a government response, and I think that made them upset. And, you know, they were sick of living this way. And the thing is that, you know, they were getting back on their feet after Irma swept through. And then Maria just really knocked the soul out of a lot of people just because it set them back kind of to square one. But they are always in good spirits. And it's kind of like they're living in this alternative universe, and they've really kind of fought to get back to normal, and they're extremely resilient. So we were driving like through one of these crazy roads and there was traffic jam because one of the power lines, which are just kind of all over the place, like tossed askew, it's kind of wild, was in the way. And this guy just casually gets out of his car and moves the down power line aside and gets back in his car and keeps driving. Mm. It's just like your like run of the mill, normal, like Monday morning activity. So they've been doing a lot of the work themselves.
Brianna Sachs with BuzzFeed News on St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. Brianna, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think there's a healing effect to theater.
That's the voice there of playwright Lin-Manuel Miranda, somebody who's become a master at creating experiences that transport theatergoers to another time and another space, like in his hit musical, Hamilton.
There's something about everyone being in the same room and having the same experience that is powerful and increasingly rare.
Josie Whittlesey is trying to harness that same power, but her stage isn't on Broadway, it's in jails and detention centers. Whittlesey is executive director of Drama Club. It's an organization that teaches theater to incarcerated youth. Lately, she's been working with young women at Rikers Island. That's New York's main jail complex, where on any given day, there are about 9,500 people detained, most of them awaiting trial or sentencing.
This program for them is great. I think it gives them, especially that they're young at age, you want to have fun, and they still feel like these girls are their friends. So this is an atmosphere where they can see other girls from different housing areas and still have relationships with them.
That's Angela Gonzalez, a Rikers corrections officer. And here's Wynette Jackson, deputy commissioner for youthful offender and youth adult programming.
Safety is the priority. And we know and we connect idle time with violence. So we know that if we connect young people and adults in meaningful programming, we reduce the opportunity for violence.
The Takeaway's Amber Hall recently went to Rikers to watch the Drama Club's latest performance. Josie Whittlesey narrates us through the experience of working with inmates and putting on their latest play.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for coming. I know it is not an easy thing to get here, but we got here.
The day the play was performed was a very stressful day for me. I had actually tried to go in the night before to do an emergency rehearsal. I got all the way to the jail, and they said, oh, we're sorry, it's locked down. So I was already on edge. And then I had to meet our audience. I think we had 11 guests. Take them over the bridge on the city bus, take them through the processing, which is stressful, get on the internal bus. And then when we got there, there was an alarm, which means there's no movement. And then there was another alarm, and I really started to panic. And now what I didn't know is that the girls had been on lockdown for 24 hours before we started, and several of them told me they thought the play was canceled, but nobody told me that, thank God.
We're going to play our favorite game.
I founded Drama Club in 2013.
Yes, okay. And someone is going to volunteer to teach it.
I decided I really would like to teach theater to incarcerated youth.
So you're going to actually say zip as you pass it along, and then I say bang. You can say bang, and then I reverse it.
The games are really important for a lot of reasons. We work with young people, so there's the play. So obviously in jail and detention centers, there's not a lot of play. We're working with young people who, by and large, have not been given the opportunity to be children. So one of the things that we try to do is let them feel like kids for the hour and a half or 2 hours that we have class with them. To be totally cliche, like laughter is healing and it's equalizing and it's a way for us to get connected. I think also the games force us to look in each other's eyes, and that's powerful. So we played the game and we warmed up and the audience sat down and they started.
My role was the co-host along with April.
We met Nicole 9 months ago, and she, you know, she's the only white girl in that population, so you notice her. And she was pretty, like, open with us right away, but she didn't want to partake in the programming. She kind of wanted to talk to us, and then she was like, no, I can't act. But she started really taking a lot of leadership in the games and the improvisations.
it was bizarre. So she would do like an amazing performance and then she'd be like, no, I'm not an actor. And that just grew and grew. And finally we were like, do you see yourself? You're acting. You're like chomping at the bit to get up and play. So, and we really had to convince her to be in the show.
American woman gained the right to vote!
It's almost like a safety net when we have program Tuesdays and Fridays. I know that when I go down there, I'm going to laugh, I'm going to have a good time, and I'm going to be comfortable. Jail is not easy, and what people say about it is true. It's that scary place where people take advantage of each other and prey on one another. So to have something with emotional and physical safety, almost kind of as a guarantee, is nice to have.
So, today we are going to have a lot of women come on stage and tell their story. But first, we need our historian, East Marie. Yeah!
The historian actually says everything, what the woman had to go through to gain the right to vote. Meaning going to prison.
The fight was long and hard because President Woodrow Wilson did not take the woman seriously. The woman stood outside the White House holding banners, fighting for the right to vote.
East Marie is another, she's extremely shy. She kept coming to the rehearsals. If someone keeps coming, I like to honor that, even if they're not participating. We really encourage that. She showed up one day and she said, I went to the school floor and I did all this research. And she'd written a whole page about the suffrage movement. And it was like, just perfect, this facts, everything. So I thought, wow, so I said, would it make you feel better to read that? Improvisation really freaks her out. And she said, yeah. I was amazed that she actually did it at all. I was so proud of her. She was so proud of herself.
I've actually been in a few classes, but this is my first time acting in it, really in it. I felt good. I mean, just to stand there, because I'm actually very shy, if you haven't noticed, but I felt good.
When we meet the young people that we work with, again, there's this armor. How do we connect with that person? How do we, let them know that we really want to hear what they have to say? We want to know who they are. We think that they, have the ability to make us laugh and make each other laugh. And how do we support that person that's there? But it takes a while to get underneath that armor.
Women's rights are human rights.
Peanut is, she's shy. She, like a lot of the other girls, will speak for her. And they'll sometimes get mad at her for not speaking up for herself. But again, she kept coming. And for some reason, one night, she was like, I want to play Hillary Clinton. It was moving to me because she was connecting something there important.
They have the right to speak freely, the right to be heard, the right to be healthy and educated, the right to be free from violence, and the right to work when women flourish, communities and nations do as well. Thank you.
Yes!
I enjoyed every part of the show, and what I like about it is that everybody has fun and everybody enjoys it.
It's fun and it's stress relief, and I think it also does create a little bit of a safer environment because staff and kids are seeing each other as people as opposed to other.
Angela Gonzalez, and I'm a correction officer. Giving them hope. Giving them hope that they can go home. Like, I think that's their light of normal life instead of being where they at. So I think it's like little freedom for them.
To me, it feels to be very good around all of them. They actually push me a lot. And I feel that that's great for me because I get to show my personality, who I really am. And I think I did something to myself.
Just watching a transformation from a kind of like, whatever they believe about themselves, which is usually not not positive usually, to seeing themselves in a positive light, to seeing themselves as someone who's contributing to something, to seeing themselves as like capable of like really working together as a team, and it's profound.
Thanks to Takeaway producer Amber Hall, who traveled to Rikers Island for that story. You can catch up on anything you missed on the show by downloading our podcast. And while you're there, do us a favor, leave us a review. It actually helps other people find the show. Thanks so much for listening in the meantime. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.